Good morning.
Thank you, Gloria. It's nice to be back here at UU Church. I wandered into the chapel this morning and a lot of memories came back. I remember doing a dialogue there years ago with Brian Swim, the cosmologist, and I think another one with Rupert Sheldrick, who I've written a couple books with, a British biologist. And I remembered a couple years ago Rabbi Michael Ziegler had his wedding right out here, and we had a big reception here with a lot of Jewish dances and all that. And I've been to this marvelous gathering on a regular basis almost. So anyway, I have very good memories here with the Unitarian Church. In fact, I think it was last year when I was there, two different people came up and said, would you mind if we hired you to be our pastor? That I was not expecting. But anyway, it was a compliment, but it was also easy to say no. At my age, I've done enough administration to atone for all my sins for several lifetimes back. So enough is enough, you know. Let the younger generation deal with such realities. So, as Gloria mentioned, my most recent book is called A Way to God, Thomas Merton's Creation Spirituality Journey. How many of you know Thomas Merton? Say you've read some of his works or something. Yeah, a goodly number of you, for good reason. He clearly is one of the most articulate and marvelous artistic writers of the spiritual journey that the 20th century ever saw. And he was gifted as a writer. He always wanted to be a writer. So let me talk first part. I'm going to talk a little about his life and so forth and about my relationship with him. Then I'll get into his writings and let him do the talking, if you will. A long story short, Merton's parents, his mother was an artist from the United States, his father an artist from New Zealand. They were attending Art Institute in Paris and fell in love and got married and went to the south of Paris to a little town south of France where Merton was born. But his mother died when he was 6 or 7, quite suddenly, and then his father died when he was 14 or 15. And he was a pretty rambunctious fellow, and he ended up under the care of an uncle in England and attended school there and partied a lot, got in trouble, fathered an illegitimate child, just like St. Augustine had done. Then he ended up in New York in Columbia for his master's degree. And by the way, I met a woman who dated Merton in New York. I said, "What was he like?" And she paused and said, "He was a lot of fun." He's a great dancer. He loved music. He loved to drink. And he was very bright. So he was a great date. But that was kind of fun to meet someone who dated Merton. Then at the age of 26, he took a trip to Cuba. And he had a conversion experience at the Shrine of the Black Madonna in Cuba. And that shrine is especially interesting. It's still very much alive because it was dedicated to the slaves of the Caribbean. And so that conversion, we know how important the Black Madonna was to Merton, because in his first mass as a priest, as a monk, 1948, he dedicated it to the Black Madonna. So that experience of the archetype of the divine feminine hit him literally like a log over his head at the age of 26, because he quit his partying ways. And within a year, he had joined the Cistercian Order, the Trappists, in Louisville, outside Louisville, Kentucky. And this is a very strict order in the Catholic Church. It's essentially contemplative. They're not supposed to talk much at all. In fact, they've developed a sign language over the centuries. And they get up in the middle of the night, literally, to pray and so forth. So this is a very strict order. And he thrived there for many years. And he wrote his autobiography that became a bestseller, Seven Story Mountain. That came out in the late 40s. And it had a tremendous effect. I think one of the main reasons is it was after the war, and I think a lot of young men had what we now have a name for, namely, what is it, after war? PTS. Right. And here was this guy who was talking about the contemplative side to existence. So a lot of people were attracted to the contemplative life, a lot of men, at that time because of Merton's writings. But a major thing happened to him in 1958, because from 1940, when he entered the order, to 1958, his writings are essentially dualistic, including his autobiography. They're very Augustinian. They're all about leaving the world behind and leaving the body behind and all this stuff. Very dualistic. But in 1958, he met D.T. Suzuki in his writings, the Japanese Buddhist philosopher who brought Zen to North America. And in their correspondence, Suzuki said, "Read your one Zen thinker of the West, Meister Eckhart." And Merton said, "Well, he's been condemned by the church." And Suzuki said, "Well, I can't help that. If you want to know Buddhism, read Eckhart." So Merton did start reading Eckhart in 58, and he flipped. 180-degree turn. You can see in the pre-Eckhart and pre-Buddhist writings up to 1958, there's this dualistic regret for body and matter and all the rest. But post 58, there's this prophetic, dynamic Christian. After reading Eckhart and more Buddhism, he wrote books like Confessions of a Guilty Bystander, Confessions of a Guilty Bystander, and all kinds of books that were either about politics or about the East, including books on Taoism and Sufism and Buddhism. And then in 1968, also at this time, during the Vietnam War, he was the first American religious figure to come out publicly against the Vietnam War. He beat King to it. Now, he and King became good friends. In fact, the weekend that King marched in Memphis, his last days on earth, he had been scheduled to come to Merton's monastery for a retreat with Merton and Thich Nhat Hanh, because Merton was also a buddy with Thich Nhat Hanh. They were going to have a retreat together, and at the last minute, King opted out to go on the garbage march collection, garbage workers march, and of course was murdered. And Merton writes about that after the fact, how history might have been changed if King had chosen the retreat over the march. But so Merton became really a political figure. He was the chief mentor to the Berrigan brothers, who in the late 60s were, as you may recall, some of you, being chased by the FBI all over the country and imprisoned for nonviolent actions against the Vietnam War and militarism in general. So they would go repeatedly to the monastery to meet with Merton, who kind of coached them and supported them very much. He was also close to Joan Baez, who had a picnic with him in the monastery grounds. She said the first thing he asked her was, "Will you get me a cheeseburger?" Now, the Trappists are strict vegetarians. And then she said he drank and got a little tipsy too. So she kind of spilled the beans about another side to Merton. But so he was activist in his way. And of course, one thing that I really was surprised by was how rich and prolific was his correspondence. He had correspondence that was going with Pasternak, with all kinds of Latin American poets, with, of course, they've actually done a book of his correspondence with the Czechoslovakian playwright. I have trouble pronouncing the name. No, not Havlov. Mislavik, or something like that. What's the last name? No, begin with an M. Mislach. So, okay, yes, that's it. Thank you. There's a whole book on that, their correspondence. And he had a very deep correspondence with Rosemary Ruther, the Catholic feminist theologian, who was only 28 at the time. She was teaching at Howard University, the Black University in Washington, D.C., and Merton was 50. But they had this very candid correspondence, and she really got a matter because she was in the first wave of feminism, but she really says a lot about him. That first of all, he was not on a high horse at all. She was very blunt with him, and I think sometimes overly blunt. I think she might say that in her later years, but it was an amazing correspondence. So he made himself very vulnerable to all the new movements. He was a true French intellectual. But he was. And as well as being a contemplative and as well as being an activist. Now, in 1967, I wrote him because I was then a young Dominican, 25 years old or so. And I had gone to my superiors in my seminary there, theology school, and said, look, my generation is going to be less interested in religion and more interested in spirituality. But you don't have anyone here teaching spirituality. No one here with a doctorate in spirituality, so you should send someone to get a doctorate in spirituality, and I'm glad to volunteer, I said. She came to me months later and said, good news, you can go to Europe and get a doctorate in spirituality. I said, great, where do I go? They said, go to Spain. I said, Spain? We don't need more 16th century Spanish Carmelite spirituality. Thank you. No, thank you. Well, then go to Rome. I said, Rome for spirituality? Are you kidding? Well, wise guy, they said, where should you go? I said, I don't know, but I know where I shouldn't go. I shouldn't go to Rome and I shouldn't go to Spain. Let me write Thomas Merton. They thought I was crazy. So I wrote Merton, and 4 days later, I got a full-page letter from Merton, and he said, among other things, go to Paris, the Institut Catholique in Paris. So I went back to my superiors and said, now I know where I have to go, Paris. Paris, they said, we've never sent anyone to France who came home again. And I said, well, I need to go. Merton says, no, you can't go to Paris. But Merton says, no, you can't. So for 3 months there was a stand-up. I'd be hitting him over the head with Merton's letters saying, I got to go to Paris. Finally, they relented. And they said, okay, you can go to Paris. Then years later, they regretted that I came back. I think they would have preferred if I'd stayed in France, but that's another story. So anyway, it was in Paris that I met my mentor, Père Chenu, C-H-E-N-U, a wonderful French Dominican, who's really the grandfather of liberation theology, as well as creation spirituality. He's the one who named the creation spiritual tradition, a marvelous historian. And by the way, in doing this book, I found in Merton's journals, he goes on about Chenu and how important Chenu was to him for giving him an historical perspective on the end of the Constantinian era, on the whole movement in Western Christianity and Catholicism in particular, around right-wing politics, where Vatican II was meant to be an end of that. And for a while it was. And therefore it was the birth of liberation theology. But so Merton and I had that correspondence, and then 6 months later he sent me a pile of papers that he hadn't published, including notes, outlines that he did for talks for the novices and for the monks and so forth, and he said, these may be of interest to you sometime. And he died 6 months later. Now, he died, as many of you may know, because he took a trip east. He was so taken with all he was learning about Eastern wisdom. And so he made this journey east. And he kept a journal called The Asian Journal, published after his death. He met on this trip, he met the Dalai Lama. They practically fell in love. The Dalai Lama was only 32 years old. He never met a Christian before. So the first Christian the Dalai Lama met was Merton. He met many great Hindu leaders and others on that trip. And he had himself a profound mystical experience at a great Buddhist shrine in Sri Lanka. And then a few days later, he went to Bangkok to deliver this talk entitled Karl Marx and Monasticism. Now, this is 1968. It's not the most prudent title for a talk in 1968 in Southeast Asia. This is the height of the Vietnam War. And 3 hours after that talk, he was dead. Healthy man, 53 years old, he was dead. And we've been told to believe that he stepped out of a shower and plugged the fan in and was electrocuted. I believe he was assassinated by our government. And I have spoken to 3 CIA agents now over the past 20 years. And I said, did you guys kill Merton? The first one said to me, I'll neither affirm it nor deny it. The second one said this. He said, at that time in the CIA in Southeast Asia, we were swamped with money with absolutely no accountability whatsoever. We were just flooded with money. He said, any CIA agent who felt Merton was a threat to America could have had him done in with no questions asked. And of course, it was at a retreat center. He had been talking to 150 monks and nuns. There was absolutely no security, of course. Then, after the book came out, a month after the book came out, I sat down with a third CIA agent who had been there, and I said, did you guys kill Merton? He said, yes. And he said, the last 40 years of my life, I've been trying to cleanse my soul of what I did as a young man in Southeast Asia in the name of the CIA. So I think that this is proven now, that Merton died a martyr to the peace cause, among other things. So, another part of Merton that needs to be acknowledged with gratitude is his ecological consciousness. When Rachel Carson came out with Silent Spring, as you know, the launching of the environmental movement, most historians will point to that as a point. She was immediately jumped on by the scientific establishment. They said, this is an hysterical woman. She's in love with bunnies and trees. But Merton read the book immediately and wrote a 3-page letter to her and said, thank God, thank you so much. You explained so much in this book. For example, he said, when I first arrived at this farm, the monastery in 1940, the birds were everywhere. And there are so few around these days. Your book explains why. He said, because of your book, we're ceasing immediately all DDT on the farm, the monastery farm, etc., etc. He went on and on to praise her, to thank her, and to acknowledge her. So this is the kind of person Merton was. He was alive, he was awake, and he was not afraid to speak out. And as you'll see now as you get more into his own words. Now, what I do in the book is the first chapter actually exegetes his letter to me because it deserves unpacking. There's a lot of layers to it. And it's very wonderful. It even refers to the LSD movement of the 60s. And remember, this would have been 1967 when we were corresponding. He died December 10th, 1968, the very same day that he entered the order in 1940, December 10th. But I go into the 4 paths of creation spirituality because this is the backbone of that tradition. And you can see, I wanted to see how deeply Merton mines those 4 paths. The via positiva, the path of awe and joy. The via negativa, the path of silence and contemplation, letting go, and also suffering. The via creativa, creativity. And then the via transformativa, the path of justice and compassion. And you realize Merton is a warrior on each of those paths. He's profound. He's marvelous in his writings about them, his articulation of them, and this is clearly his journey. So that's really what I'm talking about in this book. That this is the journey. Merton was undoing the fall redemption tradition that he led for 18 years as a dualistic monk. And then it was Eckhart and Buddhism that led him to another path. By the way, the Dalai Lama was asked last year, do you believe in God? And he paused and he said, well, yes, I believe in God. And the journalist said, well, are you sure? A lot of Buddhists don't believe in God. They don't use it. Want to use the name God and everything. So what kind of God do you believe in? And Dalai Lama paused and he said, I believe in the God of Thomas Merton. So I think that's a pretty good reference to have. And the Dalai Lama has visited his grave at the monastery and is obviously very, very attached still to Merton. Because he met him at a very important age, at 32, when he had just left his country and all that. And I think he was moved by his story. So let Merton do some of the talking now, because he's such a great artist of words. And let's begin with the Via Positiva. By the way, as far as the methodology goes, so I go through the four paths, that's the four chapters. I also go through my trial with Cardinal Ratzinger. Because Cardinal Ratzinger accused me of seven heresies, the first of which is that I'm a feminist theologian. That's number one. And then another two is that I call God Mother. This is a Rorschach test on the Ratzinger and John Paul II papacies. So I go through these seven accusations and bring Merton into the docket with me, you see, and I show that Merton is just as guilty of these as I am, that we're on the same page. And that was kind of fun. It was kind of sweet vengeance. By the way, I think this is the only book I've ever written where I quote a pope on the back. This is Pope Francis. When he spoke in Congress a couple of years ago, he said this. He invoked Merton. He said, Merton was above all a man of prayer, a thinker who challenged the servitudes of his time and opened new horizons for souls and for the church. He was also a man of dialogue, promoter of peace between peoples and religions. So for a pope, that's a pretty good endorsement of Merton. So here's Merton on the Via Positiva. He says, contemplation is the highest expression of man's intellectual and spiritual life. It is that life itself, fully awake, fully active, fully aware that it is alive. This sounds a lot like Howard Thurman. Howard Thurman talks a lot about God as life and about being fully alive. It is spiritual wonder. It is spontaneous awe at the sacredness of life, of being. It is gratitude for life, for awareness, and for being. That's a brilliant summary of the Via Positiva. The Via Positiva is about gratitude for life, about the excitement of being. And interesting, Merton says this is really the meaning of contemplation, to fall in love with life. And he says, our real journey in life is interior. It is a matter of growth, deepening, and an ever-growing surrender to the creative action of love and grace in our hearts. Never was it more necessary for us to respond to that action. Now, of course, I'm sharing Merton with you in the context of the last 2 weeks of news. I don't know about you, but I've gotten a lot of email from people who are scared, depressed, burned out, or marching a lot, etc., etc. I mean, we're going through something, no question about it, not just we Americans, but everyone around the world. So I think it's precisely in this context that Merton's depth, both as being being-oriented, that mystical side of our consciousness that we're all capable of, the contemplation, and being active as well, and wisely and effectively active. I think, to me, this context in which we're talking about Merton is perfect, because this is where he has so much to offer us. Now, his love of nature is everywhere. Now, Merton was part Celtic. His mother's family was Welsh. And he writes about that in his journal. He kept these amazing journals, utterly candid, journals, but they weren't published till 25 years after he died. And at one point he makes in there, he said, "Thank God for my Celtic soul," he said. It's this that has gotten me in trouble, and so forth. By the way, I'd like to say, because it was Merton who sent me to Paris, where I met my mentor in the Christ spiritual tradition, I can honestly say that it's to Merton that I owe all the trouble that I got in. Definitely. It wouldn't have happened if I'd stayed in the States. Here's one of his, he talks about worshiping nature. "Warm sun. Perhaps these yellow wildflowers have the minds of little girls. My worship is a blue sky and 10,000 crickets in the deep wet hay of the field. My vow is the silence under their song. I admire the woodpecker and the dove and simple mathematics of flights. Together we study practical norms. The plowed and planted field is red as a brick in the sun and says, 'Now my turn.' Several of us begin to sing." "The rain has stopped. The quails begin their sweet whistling in the wet bushes. Their noise is absolutely useless, and so is the delight I take in it. There is nothing I would rather hear, not because it is a better noise than other noises, but because it is the voice of the present moment, the present festival." Every moment is a festival. Every moment is a festival. And of course, it takes other beings, like the birds, to remind us of this and to break through the human noise to get to deeper places in our soul. "Every plant stands in the light of the sun. Every plant that stands in the light of the sun is a saint and an outlaw." I love that combination. A saint and an outlaw. That's who Merton was. "Every tree that brings forth blossoms without the command of man is powerful in the sight of God. Every star that man has not counted is a world of sanity and perfection. Every blade of grass is an angel singing in a shower of glory. These are worlds of themselves. No man can use or destroy them." And in one of his journals he says, "Dance in the sun, you tepid idiot. Wake up and dance in the clarity of perfect contradiction. You fool, it is life that makes you dance. Have you forgotten?" Now, Merton in the monastery, after a number of years in the monastery, and after he started reading Eckhart and Buddhism, felt a yearning to become a hermit. And that is actually in the tradition. And but he had to fight as abbot for 6 years to be allowed to set up a hermitage on the grounds of the monastery and live there instead of in the monastery itself. And he would still participate in much of the liturgy going on in the monastery, but he wanted his hermitage. So finally he got his own hermitage. And by the way, I was living in a hermitage at that time too, so that was part of my correspondence to Merton. I think it's one reason he replied to me so swiftly, and he happened to know the ex-Benedictine abbot who was head of the hermitage that I was staying in on Vancouver Island. So, and I didn't know that till I got his journal. He talks about Abbot Winandi. That was my boss in the hermitage. But here in this beautiful passage, he writes about being in the hermitage. "I live in the woods out of necessity. I get out of bed in the middle of the night because it is imperative that I hear the silence of the night alone and with my face on the floor say psalms alone in the silence of the night. The silence of the forest is my bride, and the sweet, dark warmth of the whole world is my love. And out of the heart of that dark warmth comes a secret that is heard only in silence. But it is the root of all the secrets that are whispered by all the lovers in their beds all over the world." I just love what he does in that beautiful passage, where he takes a cosmic perspective of the darkness of the night. And he applies it to our most intimate personal experiences where we sleep and where we make love. A beautiful overcoming of human narcissism and solipsism, and a connecting of our psyche to the cosmos again. That is such an important connection that we've lost during the modern era, but that we're yearning to hear again. Thomas Berry, there was a marvelous little book put out on the nature writing, nature meditations of Thomas Merton, and it's called When the Trees Say Nothing. It's a line from one of Merton's poems, and Thomas Berry wrote a preface to that collection of sayings, and this is what Thomas Berry says in the preface. When we see a flower, a butterfly, a tree, when we feel the evening breeze flow over us or wade in a stream of clear water, our natural response is immediate, intuitive, transforming, ecstatic. Everywhere we find ourselves invaded by the world of the sacred. Such was the experience of Thomas Merton. Such is the wonder it is communicating to us. So that the Via Positiva is about reconnecting to the sacred, which is continuously in communion with us. As Meister Eckhart said, God is at home, it's we who've gone out for a walk. So it's about returning to this awareness that we knew as children and that we have a right to rediscover. So that's the Via Positiva. Now let's turn to the Via Negativa. Now, Eckhart had a lot to say about silence. And, of course, Merton was deeply, deeply impacted by Eckhart. In fact, in his last book, Asian Journal, he was writing in the margins, Eckhart is my lifeboat, Eckhart is my lifeboat. And he has that line in his journal as well. So Eckhart became really important to Merton. And that's one more proof of how what a creation-centered mystic Merton was, because Eckhart, I consider, the apogee of the creation tradition in the West. So Eckhart says, nothing in all creation is so like God as silence. And again, the best and noblest of all that one can come to in this life is to be silent and let God work and let God speak. And of course, this is his Buddhism too. Here's Eckhart. How then should one love God? You should love God mindlessly. That is, your soul is without mind and free from all mental activities. For as long as your soul is operating like a mind, so long does it have images and representations and loses simplicity. Therefore, our soul should be bare of all mind and should stay there without mind. For if you love God as God or mind or person or picture, all that must be dropped. How then shall you love God? Love God as God is, a not God, not mind, not person, not image. Even more, as God is a pure, clear one, separate from all two-ness. We should sink eternally from something to nothing into this one. May God help us to do this. Amen. That's Eckhart. It's raw Buddhism. Pure Buddhism, and he never met a Buddhist in his life, never read a Buddhist book in his life. He found this as a Christian in his meditation, which just proves the wisdom of Buddhism, that their deepest truths are in fact universal. So here's Merton on silence. Be still. Listen to the stones of the wall. Be silent. They try to speak your name. Listen to the living walls. Who are you? Whose silence are you? And again, the whole world is secretly on fire. The stones burn. Even the stones, they burn me. How can a man be still or listen to all things burning? How can one dare to sit with them when all their silence is on fire? Love winter when the plant says nothing, says Merton. And he has a marvelous essay on Ionesco's play, The Rhinoceros. He says, modern man is the man in a rush, that is, a rhinoceros, man who has no time, who is a prisoner of necessity, who cannot understand that a thing might perhaps be without usefulness. If one does not understand the usefulness of the useless and the uselessness of the useful, one cannot understand art. And a country where art is not understood is a country of slaves and robots. A pretty prophetic line. Yeah? The whole thing or the last part? A country where art is not understood is a country of slaves and robots. Rhinoceritis is the sickness that lies in wait for those who have lost the sense and the taste for solitude. So he's invoking this all-important need we all have for solitude. We have to give it attention. We have to bracket and make room for it in our lives, even if it's a 5 minute sitting when you start the day. Role of solitude, getting in touch with solitude. And this is the apophatic divinity, the divinity without a name, as Eckhart said, a God who has no name and will never be given a name. Super essential darkness, says Eckhart. That God, that's the apophatic divinity, the God of the darkness. And Merton has a lot to say about that. Now, one of Merton's very last books was Zen and the Bird of Appetite, which is really the summary of his dialogues with Dr. Suzuki. So Suzuki's deep, big in that book, and it's a small book. And Eckhart is very deep and present in that book. But it really is a profound journey into the via negativa, into the apophatic divinity, into silence. And what Merton says, I am the utter poverty of God. I am God's emptiness, littleness, nothingness, lostness. When this is understood, my life in his freedom, the self-emptying of God in me is the fullness of grace. And then Merton says, and this is really an echo of Eckhart, as soon as a person is fully disposed to be alone with God, one is alone with God no matter where one may be, in the country, the monastery, the woods, or the city. The lightning flashes from east to west, illuminating the whole horizon and striking where it pleases. And at the same instant, the infinite liberty of God flashes in the depths of that person's soul, and such a one is illuminated. At that moment, one sees that though one seems to be in the middle of one's journey, one has already arrived at the end. For the life of grace on earth is the beginning of life of glory. Although a traveler in time, one has opened his eyes for a moment in eternity. Now, Merton had an experience in Louisville at lunchtime, in busy lunchtime, people running all over the place at 4th and, well, not. He had a mystical experience in the middle of all this. And the next day he wrote in his journal, how is it possible to tell people that they're all walking around shining like the sun? It was an experience of the cosmic Christ that he found in everybody in downtown Louisville at this time. And this is so important to the people of Louisville. They have put up a sign now at 4th and Walnut saying, this is where Thomas Merton had his mystical experience. And they told me they think that this is the only sign in North America that commemorates a mystical experience. Now the Via Creativa, Merton and creativity. When Merton was in the monastery, he took up photography. And one of his very closest friends, and he had a lot of friends, was a professional photographer who kind of coached him. And so photography for Merton from the kickoff was, in fact, what we call artist meditation. It was a meditation experience. He realized that when you get serious about looking carefully at things, including shapes and shadows and sun and all the rest that a photographer has to do, this is a focusing device. This is a meditation. And what's interesting in his choices of subjects to take pictures of, 90% of them are of broken things. They're of the via negativa. They're not of pretty things. For example, I reproduce in the book, because I went to his center, the Thomas Merton Center. In fact, this book grew from that, because last year was the centennial of Merton's birth. And he was born in 1915. And so I was invited to speak at his center, which is in Louisville, to commemorate his centennial. And they said, here's the topic. Talk about you and Merton. And I changed it. I talked about me, Merton, and Eckhart, because Eckhart is so important to both Merton and me. But I also visited it's like a museum they have there with a lot of artifacts, including his typewriter. And he did all this correspondence and all these books, with email, not even on a computer, but on an old-fashioned typewriter. It's really amazing that he did so much and died at 53. I mean, it's just amazing how busy he was and still contemplative. But they had some of his photography up, and I was really struck by this one photograph, and it's of a big wooden wheel, old wooden wheel, but it's battered and bruised. So I reproduced that in the very last chapter, because it says so much, I think, about life and about the circle of life, and he talks about the circle of life, and it's a wonderful photograph. But I also have a picture here of him with his camera and a big smile, because he obviously enjoyed doing his photography, again, as a practice, spiritual practice. He says, there is something in my nature that gets the keenest and sharpest pleasure out of achievement, out of work finished and printed and distributed and read. So he's an artist. And his being and his birthing are of the same ilk. They're of the same energy. It's the via creativa. The Holy Spirit is at work in our creativity. And that was very much his teaching. He says, the theology of creativity will necessarily be the theology of the Holy Spirit, reforming us in the likeness of Christ, raising us from death to life with the very same power which raised Christ from the dead. The theology of creativity will also be a theology of the image and likeness of God in humanity. So he had a theological basis. Now, he didn't have this language of the via creativa. I came up with that language when I was studying Eckhart for the first time. I realized that the via positiva and the via negativa are not enough. There's also the via creativa, which is really born of the first two paths, of the darkness of the via negativa and of the light of the via positiva. But Merton was not only a very accomplished writer, obviously, and poet. He was a major poet. Photography, too. But he loved music. And it's very interesting that he used to go to Louisville, sneak away from the monastery and get into Louisville, make up an excuse, I gotta see a doctor. That's how you get out of a monastery, you gotta see a doctor. And then he would sneak over to the black part of town, the ghetto, this was the 60s, early 60s, in Louisville, to go to jazz clubs. And to this day, there are 80-year-old black guys in Louisville. They're now interviewing these guys. There were young men in the jazz world of Louisville in the 60s. And they talk about this oddball, this white guy who showed up, the only white guy who ever showed up, and would sit in the back. And all he wanted to do, they say, was talk about Zen meditation and jazz. That was Thomas Merton. And when I was part of this conference last year in Louisville, one great event they had in the evening was a jazz festival led by a fellow who was a young man in Merton's day, a hippie, literally, in the 60s, who would go and visit Merton on a regular basis with and they'd do jazz together. And Merton played the piano. And so he had this band with him last year, all of them older people now, but it was a marvelous because then they had slides of him and Merton together, and he was, you know, just a young guy and all this. And it was really fun just bringing that alive and feeling the energy. So jazz was extremely important to Merton. A lot of music was, but especially about jazz. Now another, here's a wonderful poem that I love by Merton about singing the office. You see, the practices that the monks have, including singing the psalms, they get up in the middle of the night to do it, and then during the day as well. This is a deep part of their practice. And of course, the psalms are wisdom literature. That means they're the feminist literature of the Bible. And here's Merton, this beautiful short poem about singing the psalms. When psalms surprise me with their music, and antiphons turn to rum, an antiphon is a prayer that they throw in the middle of singing the psalms. But I love that. Antiphons turn to rum. The spirit sings. The bottom drops out of my soul. And from the center of my cellar, love, louder than thunder, opens a heave of naked air. That is such a beautiful passage. And notice, it's so feminist. It's God from below. God is in the cellar of our soul and gets released when we sing. When psalms surprise me with their music and antiphons turn to rum, the spirit sings, the bottom drops out of my soul. And from the center of my cellar, love, louder than thunder, opens a heave of naked air. And of course, air is the same word as spirit. Merton says, poetry is not ordinary speech, nor is poetic experience ordinary experience. It is closer to religious experience. Rasa is above all santa, contemplative peace. He wrote that in his journal East. Now, the art of friendship was also very, very important to Merton. And his friends knew that. And this is very French. It's not very American. I tell the story about how when I was studying in France, and I spent my last summer there in the Pays Basque, and living on a farm, to write my doctoral thesis. And it was the time that we landed to land on the moon. First man on the moon. And I was at this Basque inn run by a family that I ate at most every evening. And they came up to me and said, come in the back room and watch the man land on the moon. And this little black and white TV, so there he was. And then they said, there's a man out here who wants to see you. And this old Basque priest, 91 years old, with a cane, came limping in the room. Shook my hand and said, congratulations, he said. You Americans put a man on the moon. You're the only ones who put a man on the moon. But he said, when it comes to friendship, you Americans are morons. And he turned around and went out the room, and I never saw him again. And that was, 50 years ago. I've never forgotten that sentence from this old, old man. When it comes to friendship, you Americans are morons. Well, as I point out, Merton was not a moron. Merton invested in friendship, even though he was a contemplative monk, even though he lived in a hermitage. And he had a very profound introvert side, I assure you. There's one story he tells in his journal where he's been walking the monastery grounds there, the farm, and he comes back and there are these three priests at his front door of his hermitage. He hid behind a tree till they would go. You know, they were not invited. He didn't know them. But, I just, being an introvert myself, I felt perfectly what he felt, you know. They were invading his hermitage. The whole purpose of a hermitage is solitude. And you can invite people you want to invite, whether it's Joan Baez or Daniel Berrigan, but these strangers, no thanks. But friendship meant a lot to Merton. He had a genius for friendship, says John Howard Griffin, who was his very close friend. He was a photographer who oversaw his photography. And You know, he wrote the book Black Like Me in the early 60s. He took a drug that changed his skin color to dark, and then he took a bus through the South, and he wrote this book, Black Like Me, and about how life is different when you got a different pigment in your skin. You know, a very important book. I remember reading it back then. And of course, he was a real intellectual. His correspondence included Dorothy Day, with whom he was very close, James Forrest, Jean and Hildegard Gosmeyer, Dana Philip Berrigan, Gordon Zahn, Lawrence Figlie-Getty, Wendell Berry, who visited him in the Hermitage, Boris Pasternak, Czeslaw Milots, who we talked about, Bill Everson, Brother Antoninus from California, Henry Miller. Oh, yeah. We'll be getting to that when we get the Via Transformativa. Eric Fromm, Carl Stern, scientist Leo Szilard, and many others. On his journey, he met Trungpa Rinpoche in India, who was just a young man at the time, who later came here and started Naropa University, and they hit it off very in a big way, too. They stayed in touch, and Merton really liked him. He even taught the novices how to weave blankets. Baskets, I mean. He said, I want as many novices as possible to learn how to weave baskets. So we can see that creativity is very important to him. Now, in his last talk, just before he died, here are some of the people he quoted. Ruth Benedict, Anais Nin, Denise Levertov, William Blake, Dom Leclerc, Herbert Marcuse, Roger Garaudy, who is a Marxist, Teresa of Avila, Ludwig Feuerbach, Teilhard de Chardin, Carl Jung, St. Bernard, St. Augustine, Karl Marx, Eric Fromm, St. Paul, the Dalai Lama, St. Benedict, Trungpa Rinpoche, Sartre, Carl Jaspers, Rilke, Jacques Maritain, and others. That was in his last talk, entitled Karl Marx and Monasticism. And of course, as I said, he was so naive. This is a typical monk. He was going around Southeast Asia before his talk, saying in English, going up to people saying, I'm giving a talk on Karl Marx and Monasticism. Any ideas about what I should say? Well, the CIA was also going around listening in English, and they knew what was going on with his last talk. So there's no question that Merton, and by the way, Blake was very important to Merton. He did his, I think it was his undergraduate thesis on Blake. And he always loved Blake. So now the Via Transformativa, struggle to change the world with justice and compassion. He says, in the conflict between law and freedom, God is on the side of freedom. That is a scandalous statement, but it is the New Testament. How are we going to affirm in the modern world the scandal of the New Testament? It is here that we confront the seriousness of our prophetic as distinct from our contemplative calling. Now, I just think it's very important that he can see the two arenas, the contemplative, the mystical, and the prophetic. They are distinct, but of course they are connected. And that's certainly been my whole life's work, just to bring the mystical and the prophetic alive in us. We can redo our education to bring that prophet alive. And
Dr. Falk?
Yes.
5 more minutes before question and answer.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, my goodness. When I get talking about Merton, I get carried away. I have not been watching. Oh, dear. Well, you've talked about ecology. He takes on, the subject of technology. And I think this is especially important today, too. But he had kind of a running fight with technology. In his day, the big thing happening was, of course, the landing of the man on the moon, which happened a year after he died. But he was one of the few people who questioned it. Just a second, I'll be right with you. 121. Okay. He said this about that. He said, even if we can fly, so what? There are flying ants. Even if humans fly all over the universe, we are still nothing but a flying ant. until we recover a human center and a human spirit in the depth of our own being. What can we gain by sailing to the moon if we are not able to cross the abyss that separates us from ourselves? This is the most important of all voyages of discovery. And without it, all the rest are not only useless, but disastrous. This is really important at our time. As I like to point out, every gadget produced by Silicon Valley gets picked up by ISIS immediately. The fellow who murdered 50 people in Orlando was on Facebook at the time. So gadgets are not going to save us, folks. We have to go deeper. And that's what Merton was proposing 50 years ago. And we have to hear this message even more strongly today. And we have to hear it in Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley has to hear this and respond appropriately. My proposal is that they tax themselves, not the government, they tax themselves, a tiny tax, tiny fraction of 1%. And they give that money to spiritual groups that are trying to get to this level of reality that Merton is pushing. Because I don't know a genuine spiritual group today that couldn't use some support. And the ungenuine ones, you know who they are because they're making lots of money. But that's just one of his, you know, he had a lot to say about racism, of course. And of course, having come from Europe and from France, he had an awareness of that was fresher than a lot of. He not only supported King, but he supported Malcolm X, and told people to sit and listen. And then, of course, as I said, he actually died a martyr. Now, here, let me close with this poem by him. It's a wonderful poem. And of course, he was a feminist in the best sense of the word. We don't have time to go into that right now. But let me close with this poem. It's called First Lesson About Man, meaning humanity. Man begins in zoology. I think that's his affirmation of evolution. He is a saddest animal. He drives a big red car called anxiety. Whenever he goes to the phone to call joy, he gets the wrong number. Therefore, he likes weapons. He knows all guns by their right names. He drives a big black Cadillac called death. Now he is putting anxiety into space. He flies his worries all around Venus, but it does him no good. Man is the saddest animal. He begins in zoology and gets lost in his own bad news. This is vintage Merton. It's clear, it's direct, and it's deep, and it's challenging. And that's who Merton was. He challenges us. He was a prophet. He did interfere. And he was a mystic. And I think he is what all of us have to be today at this very trying time in our country and our species and our planet's history. We all have to go deeper into our mystical side, that love of life and love of being, and into the prophetic side of action and resistance. So I think Merton is a voice for our time. I just want to say one word about another book I wrote this year with Bishop Mark Andrus in the Cathedral, Stations of the Cosmic Christ, where we linked up with artists, M.C. Richards, who left me her I Am clay tablets, the seven I Ams when she died, and they hung at St. John the Divine Cathedral in New York for two or three years. And then a local artist, Javier Garcia Limas, Ulrich Javier Garcia Limas from El Salvador, lives in San Francisco. He did the other nine cosmic Christ images of the, for example, the baptism, the nativity, the Pentecost, and so forth. And this recovery of the cosmic Christ, it links to to Merton. I told you about that experience he had about seeing the Christ, the light in everybody. But he saw it in all beings. And that is the teaching of the cosmic Christ. It's also the teaching of the image of God from Judaism. It's also the teaching of the Buddha nature from Buddhism. And altogether, what these mean, it's about recovering the sacredness of being. And so these archetypes, I think, are very important in our time, and they were very important to Merton, too. He, too, talks about the Christ who is in all beings, or, if you will, what I'd say, the Buddha nature, or what has now been established by rabbinic scholars, the image of God applies to all beings, not just to humans. Okay, with that, I'll be quiet and invite, I look forward to our discussion.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
And now, questions and comments?
Yes, sir.
Could you say a few words about
that? I'm sorry, sir.
Oh, you have a microphone. I didn't know that.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes.
You'll be next.
I'm interested in the creative aspect of his poetry. And I was wondering if he was familiar with Father Malcolm Boyd and heard him Running With Me, Jesus, and where quite a few priests around about the time of the Vietnam War were writing activist and spiritual poetry.
Of course, he knew Berrigan and some of Berrigan's poetry. I don't know if he knew. I don't remember any references to Father Steve, was it Boyd again?
Malcolm Boyd,
right, yeah. I myself knew Malcolm Boyd's work, but I don't know about Merton, and I really can't answer that. Most of his poetry was not very political. It was more about consciousness, and it evolved a lot. His style evolved a lot. In fact, the very first book he published was a book of poetry, and so poetry was extremely important in his whole life. But toward the end of his life, he was publishing a poetry that was I'm not exactly sure how to name it, but stylistically it was very out of the box. But I really can't say a lot more about that. But there are books on his poetry, and you could look further. But I don't remember seeing an awful lot of the political in his poetry.
Do you think it started out coming from his interest in Asian religion?
No. The Asian religion, remember, came late. That was 1958 when that began. Then it flourished and blossomed the last 10 years of his life, along with his prophetic consciousness. That's what's interesting. But he kept, you might say, that Jewish prophetic element of saying no, and then the Buddhist element of yes as well. So, but you know, there's a whole book of, you can get all of his poetry in one volume. Again, it's footnoted here, but you can get it in one volume. New Dimensions published most of his works and his poetry. So you can get that in one big, thick volume and dive in. Yes, sir, you want to...
I was just wondering, Merton was familiar with Zen Buddhism, could you make any distinction or comment between meditation and contemplation?
I myself don't see a big difference between the two, and I don't think Merton did either. I think that in the West, contemplation is in fact a bigger name than meditation. It's kind of the goal of meditation is to bring you to contemplation, where you see the doxa, the divine presence in all beings. Whereas I think in the East, I think meditation becomes the culmination almost of the journey and the door to enlightenment. But so I think that is a difference in language between East and West, and we have to be a little careful about it because we can miss each other in the process. But for Merton, I think, and for me, contemplation is that experience essentially of non-being and non-duality, for sure, and nothingness. But it follows on the deeper connections that we make with all being. So Merton would point out how paradoxical all of this is. For example, he talks about how the monks talk about letting go of all things, but he says doesn't make any sense to let go of all things if you aren't in love with all things first. So he says you have to know art and you have to know culture, you have to know music if you're going to let go of it. Otherwise, nothing to let go of. So he's fighting anti-intellectualism, if you will, and anti-art on a regular basis, because a lot of monks, he felt, were not very enlightened people. And he felt you can be enlightened through art and through all kinds of ways, not just one way. By the way, I should mention this. It's a fact. This comes out in his journals. Merton had an affair when he was 50 years old. He was in the hospital and his nurse, and he fell in love. She was half his age. She was 25 and a Catholic nurse. And some people say, oh, my, isn't this awful? In fact, I think it's wonderful. It went on for 6 months. They were deeply in love, and then he ended it, and they agreed to it jointly. I think both of them treated each other very well. Afterwards, she got married, had two sons who became doctors, but she never once exploited it. She never once wrote about it or interviewed about it or anything else. Didn't take advantage at all. But Merton said this about it. He said, all my life I wondered if I could love another human being. You see, in his escapades as a young man, like a lot of young men, he knew sex, but he didn't know love. And at this fuller age of 50, he discovered what love was. And this is what makes him different from Augustine, besides the fact that he met Eckhart and the creation tradition in 1958 and Buddhism. But the point is, Augustine also had an affair as a young man and had a child, but he never got over it. He carried his guilt right to his deathbed, and he lived to be 76 years old. Merton died at 53, and he reconciled our humanity, including the second chakra, with the rest of his theology. And he said after it was over, he wrote, he said, it was a miracle for me. It was wonderful. But he returned then to his vow of celibacy. I think it's a very important story. And he said when he was setting up his living trust and all this, he said, I'm going to tell the truth about this in my journal. I'm not going to hide it. I want people to know who I really was. So he was very honest and candid about that too. I think it's very important because Christianity, both Protestant and Catholic, has carried Augustine's guilt for 1600 years. And it's not been healthy. I've already said if anyone needed Freud, it was Augustine. And it's because of Augustine that Freud was necessary in Catholic Austria in the 19th century and early 20th century, because they were so messed up about sexuality because of Augustine. But Merton got over that. Once you leave behind the dualisms of the Augustinian worldview, which you have to do to be a creation-centered mystic or to be a Meister Eckhart or a Buddhist, you can't carry the guilt of bodiliness into a life of contemplation for long without going a little wacky. So I think that story, first of all, it's a true story, but I think it's very significant. And it makes Merton a much, much, much more authentic theologian than Augustine ever was. I hope that Merton gets listened to for 1600 years like Augustine was listened to, because Merton, I think, has it together.
I think you yes, alluded to a connection between maybe Merton's spirituality, but then this resistance, political resistance. What's the connection between, or is there a connection between, like what happened in Berkeley several days ago or several nights ago? Is there a connection between that type of spirituality and this resistance?
Well, okay, I actually saw the front page of the Chronicle today, but the front page is about what happened in Berkeley the other day. It's a very important article because it was those anarchists, people who were too fearful to even see their face, wear masks, who co-opted the demonstrations. And this is going to happen. It happened with Occupy. And I'll tell you this. When I was marching in Occupy in Oakland, whenever it was, a couple of years ago, I'll never forget, it was a beautiful Saturday day, sun was shining. All generations were there, including babies and strollers. And there was a band playing the whole nine yards. There was even a, what do they call these dances? Flash dance and all this. A marvelous thing going. It was just a beautiful afternoon. And I noticed one of these anarchists there. He had an anarchist flag and a mask on. So I sidled up to him. And I played dumb and I said, "What's the flag?" I said, "Well, that's anarchy." Or I said, "And what's anarchy?" I played dumb again. And he gave me the stupidest answer I've ever heard in my life, straight from encyclopedia. And it immediately dawned on me, this guy's being paid either by Citibank or by the FBI. I don't know which side he's on, but he's being paid to be doing this. And that night, a dozen of these guys, anarchists with a mask, started burning and looting and all this stuff. And the next day in the paper, it was all about them, just like the Berkeley thing was a few days ago, all about them and not about these thousands of everyday people who had marched. So this, read that article. It is so important. You know, the left must not be naive. It's very easy. Imagine how simple it would be to hire a few of these anarchists, put a mask on, and pay them well, and have them destroy everything, and have them be on the front page instead of the thousands who are marching in nonviolence and peace. And, of course, that was Merton's position, nonviolence, not violence. And that's what how these anarchists with the masks on stand out, that they're violent. They're going to destroy property, and they can endanger other people. And what that does, of course, it destroys the movement. And that happened with Occupy, and it happened that night in Oakland, and that was 2 years ago. Now Berkeley's catching up to Oakland, and it's happening in Berkeley. So watch out. Don't be naive. One thing marchers should do is you should have internal security. When people come who are so afraid that they have to wear a mask, they should be evicted from the get-go because they will destroy things otherwise. That's, you know, you cannot, the left cannot be naive. And, you know, some of these people may be doing it out of their own philosophy, but all it takes is a couple to be planted. I remember from the 60s days, when I came back from America in 1970 or 69, in Dubuque, Iowa, of all places, I had meetings with the radical young people, and we were talking about things, and one guy was really radical, kind of, I thought he was kind of crazy. Well, I learned 2 years later, he was hired by the FBI. You know, in Dubuque, Iowa, of all places. Can you imagine the FBI being worried about Dubuque, Iowa? This guy was hired to explode the whole thing. So, you know, we must have learned something from the last 40 years. And one thing is, don't be naive.
I brought the Chronicle article.
Good for you. Good for you. It's on the front page.
They talk about it at previous connections.
Good, good. No, I think it's very important. I'm glad you raised the question. It's very pertinent.
I have a question about your experience. Well, actually, Merton's experience. You mentioned that Merton had visited a lot of different cultures, like Buddhist, Zen, and that kind of stuff. It strikes me that many of the things that Merton did are totally consistent with shamanism. I wonder if he's had any contact with shamanism.
Hmm.
Like the Vision Quest, for example, contemplation.
I have a whole section in here on the Native American experience. He, remember the book that came out on Ishii? And you remember who Ishii was, a survivor of that one tribe that had to go underground because the governor of California said, kill an Indian and get $50. So Ishii came out of hiding and he was at the University of California, Berkeley. The anthropologist took him in and he lived for 6 more years. And then years later, he wrote a book about it. That came out in about 63 or so. Whenever it came out, Merton immediately wrote a whole review of it. And then he wrote a book called My Name is Ishii.
And it's really powerful about the way the indigenous people have been treated on this land. And he goes on about their genius regarding ritual, regarding the cosmos and connecting cosmos and psyche. I mean, it's brilliant. I have a whole section on that in the Via Transformativa here. And what he says is just really powerful. He wrote a poem about it too. That's one of his poems. It's a long poem about the Indian experience. And there's this one line. He has the Indian saying, they, meaning the white people, are killing Eros. They are killing Eros. That's a powerful line. Because Eros is, of course, the divine feminine. And it's the passion for living. And Native American religion is matriarchal. Mother Earth is at the center in that regard. Merton really gets it. And again, a part of it is, I think, because he's an outsider, because he's a European by birth, that he sees the oppression of the native people in this country. So it's a short book, but it begins with the word genocide. He says, genocide is not a common word, but now is the time to use it. And he goes on. So it's very political, it's very strong, and it's very blunt. And I say he did write an epic poem about the whole subject, too. So all that is present in a summary fashion in my book, with the proper references so you can go and see yourself. But his book is called My Name is Ishii, and it's a powerful statement on the Native American spirit and its abuse. And of course, this is Standing Rock all over again. It's happening again. So, we can't afford to let this moment pass us up. He would be writing about Standing Rock today for sure. He was writing about it back then. And the abuse of the land and the abuse of the spirit of the land. So definitely he had a consciousness that was shamanistic in that regard. That and his love of ritual.
I'm sorry, we don't have any more time.
So
come again. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.